I'm Christopher Lydon, with doubtless the finest English newspaper editor of his time, Harold Evans. His memoir could make you weep, not for the anemic papers that are now so close to death, but for those cheeky deadline artists, the newspaper reporters and editors who are disappearing into memory and mythology like the American cowboy. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. My Paper Chase is the story of Harold Evans' addiction to printed news. True stories of vanished times, he says. Harold Evans, welcome.
Oh, delighted to be with you.
I gotta say, you break my heart and you spin my head around at a moment when I'd almost begun to think we could do without the papers, which we may have to. But these people you write about, these rag and bone men of the opinion trade, as you call yourself, these careful, quick copy editors at the Manchester Evening News, hunched men in cardigans reducing cataclysms to column inches. I love that. These reporters, gifted, as one of them said, with rat-like cunning, a plausible manner, and a little literary ability. Question is, can free democratic people live without those wretches?
Well, that's a very good... I'm glad you quoted. That's Nick Tomlin. It's rather sad. My colleague Nick Tomlin, here's a point about newspapers. He was killed on the Syrian front against the Israelis and by a sniper's... by a rocket-propelled wire-guided missile. And, of course, he was absolutely right. We are a mixed bunch. One of the great strengths of the Sunday Times when I edited it was how variegated the characters were. I mean, in term, we had a former antique dealer who actually led us to the first expose of the antique dealer's rings. We had a microbiologist. We had a woman who gutted chickens who later became Anne Robinson. At the same time, we had people like Godfrey Hodgson and Hugo Young who were Harkness Fellows, you know, like the Rhodes Scholarship coming to America. So we had a really variegated staff. Now, that is one thing which I think, not to get too melancholy, is missing today, which is the fact that young people come out of the universities and come out of high school maybe, but mainly universities, and go to colleges of journalism where they're kind of ironed out, I think. I fear they're kind of the heterogeneity that we celebrated is slightly disappearing. Whether they're going to go into the web or into newspapers, I think the business of discovering truth, which is what we're maybe going to discuss, is much assisted by the different perceptions of renegades, people who don't... like. I had a lot of Australians, for instance. You try arguing with an Australian. At the same time, I had all these very clever PhDs in my office. So whichever way you spun it, I think you put your finger on it in a talk you gave about the fact that it seems a very bohemian bunch of people, some of them drinking a lot, some of them smoking a lot, some of them not doing either of those things. We had a few aesthetes on my papers in my time. But out of this multifaceted approach to our complicated world came something very close to the truth from time to time.
Your guys, I must say, had better names. I'm thinking of your Manchester colleagues named Nifty and Bowtie and Big Tom Henry. All these stalwart characters, but very, very professional folk.
Yeah, exactly right. Well, Big Tom used to walk through the newsroom with a cigar, and he was wearing a bow tie, on his way to the Stone, which is where the metal type was assembled, which many people won't know about because it's now so easy with the digital revolution. And as he walked through, he'd have a retinue of people behind him trying to get his attention for something like a photograph or a world-shattering, Mr. Henry, Mr. Henry, Mr. Henry. And then when he got on the Stone, if somebody made a mistake in editing a copy, he'd come on the intercom saying, "Who edited that story? It's as long as Cross Street." He was kind of like Darth Vader because his voice was already pretty hoarse and stentorian, transmitted through the intercom. It sounded absolutely terrifying. I lived in fear of him. Those professionals' craftsmanship was really extraordinary. And today, when I see what passes for editing in newspapers or magazines or on the internet for that matter, so much wasted time and energy, what I call what Warren Harding called bloviation.
Could I just I just want a little further introduction of you to say that you're Sir Harold Evans now, also known as,
yes,
Mr. Tina Brown, for your wife, who edited The New Yorker and started The Daily Beast. But, I mean, the core of this book is the revelation that you're a Manchester guy from the beginning, from working-class precincts. Father cleaned railroad locomotives and eventually drove them. Your mother ran a shop out of your house. And all of that home training stuck remarkably, it seemed to me, when you worked your way to the big time at the Sunday Times in London. I mean, those were serious stories. I mean, I love it that you adore gossip, but there was very little trivia in that record. Justice for the thalidomide babies who'd been malformed by a morning sickness pill, the most famous crusade that you undertook, but there's so many others. And a whole style of platoon journalism, too, in that insight team that took on British Army brutality in Northern Ireland, took on Margaret Thatcher's Tory economics and the corruption of the Labour Party. There was not a lot of sort of blatant ideological politics about it in the Murdoch style. It's a standard that somehow got to be preserved.
Well, I'd like to think so. One of the reasons I wrote my paper chase, apart from reflecting on my life so my kids could decide whether I'd spent it well or badly, was that I wanted to give a testament to what newspapers can do. And one of the questions in our minds today is whether there can be a substitute for that profusion of information, observation, wit, adventure. Because the newspaper isn't just a headline. It's a concatenation of marvelous things, you know, like Beachcomber and the Daily Express, you know, 14 horses lodged in chimney. The text for this story has not yet arrived. I mean, ridiculous, surreal humor, which gave rise eventually, of course, to Monty Python and the Flying, all that kind of thing, came from Beachcomber. So you got that marvelous compendium of all human life, a wonderful, marvelous mosaic. At the same time, the heart of it all, and I never underestimate the other elements, the theatre criticism, the book criticism, the sports reports and so on, but at the heart of it all was the throbbing heart of investigation, of trying to find out. I'm often quoted, and I stand by it, it's more important to find out than to sound off. Mm. And we get a vast amount of sounding off today, vast amount of it, without anybody knowing what the hell they're talking about.
Mm.
I mean, for instance, just think how different our last 10 years would have been if we'd done the proper job of reporting on Iraq before we went into it.
Let's talk
but
about
the
it.
Press as a, apart from the night-written newspapers, the press as a whole swallowed the Kool-Aid. That's a great pity. One of the advantages of a plural press is that if four or five newspapers drink the Kool-Aid, two or three of them will challenge it. But in this case, only one. Well, let me give you another example.
This is important. Go ahead.
The financial meltdown we're now suffering, which is really devastating. I mean, the unemployment rate in the United States is really totally, totally appalling. And one of my criticisms of the Obama administration is they're not really concentrating enough on getting jobs, jobs, jobs. We can go into that in some detail if you want. But nonetheless, the point is this, that the symptoms of what was going to be the catastrophe of the financial meltdown were there for two, three, 4 years beforehand. Very few people picked up on the excess leverage, on the fact that the rating agencies for loans were actually basically corrupt by selling AAA ratings, on the fact that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the major mortgage brokers, were actually giving loans to people who could never in a million years afford it, and then they were bribing the congressman not to control them. All these things were well manifest long before proper newspaper reporting would have found them. Now, interestingly enough, this era overlapped with the web. And I love the web, and we'll come to that possibly, Chris. But the point is this, not even the web, not all the famous bloggers really got onto this. So we have a situation, we're entering now world where we're going to have cascades and cascades and cascades of information like rain, and none of it will reach the flower of truth.
Let's talk about Iraq, because it's clear, it's also now in the past, but it also in embarrasses British journalism too, in my opinion, in the sense that a few sound people, and there were actually plenty of them, saw this as folly and said so. But in a free country, a magnificent free country with hundreds of daily newspapers like ours, not one said, what are we thinking about here? Not one did what I, you know, was asterisk President George Bush as a selected choice of the Supreme Court. In other words, how did we get into this? It's not just a want of knowledge or want of being able to forecast the economy. It's a want of temerity and independence in stating what a lot of children could see.
Well, let's just pause for a second here. It is true that a number of people might have criticized the Iraq operation. A million people or so turned out in London. But the point is, what they were lacking and what the criticisms of that lacked was the actual evidence to say, look here, there are no weapons of mass destruction and this why. Let me give you an instance which is quite remarkable. One of my former Insight editors, a man called, I'll probably not go into his name actually because this is a bit embarrassing. Anyway, he wrote an account of why the suggestions that there were stockpiles in Iraq of anthrax were false. He couldn't get it published. He couldn't get it published because the atmosphere was gung-ho. And yet that single fact alone, if allied with others about chemical, nuclear, biological, possible weapons of mass destruction, would have been more persuasive and given more fuel to the opinions. And I keep coming back to my basic thesis in journalism, which is I love opinions, I sound off myself, but for God's sake, let's get the facts.
You remind me a lot of Tom Winship, who's always telling young reporters at the Boston Globe, you know, tell me something I don't know, get out of here, go find out something, in much right. The same spirit. Come back to the culture that made your distinguished career possible. At the core of it, I mean, there are many elements, including, I think, that your closeness to your roots and local journalism and people's stories. But at the core of it, it was the independence that came with the job. There's a moment in your book where the board of the Times newspapers sits you down and basically their question to you is, are you prepared to fight for your own independence?
It was quite when I look back at those exchanges and the minutes of that meeting when they say, will you criticize the ownership of this newspaper in their other commercial ventures, or will you suppress that criticism because it will affect that other commercial ventures? It was an amazing question to ask. They were actually saying to me, we're not going to give you the job if you're not independent. And it had already been proven to me that Roy Thomson, who owned the Times and the Sunday Times, was a man who actually believed what he said when he said, I want you to be independent. For instance, when he was applying for North Sea oil licenses, one of my colleagues who followed this subject very carefully wrote an editorial he gave to me saying these oil licenses are being given away far too cheaply to people like Thomson. Well, I published it. You'd think all hell would break loose. I never heard another thing about it. Same thing when the crew, the Thomson organization, had people in British Guiana selling a television service system, you know, the equipment and all the transmissions and stuff. And we published a very hostile piece about Chedi Jagan, who was then ruining British Guiana. I didn't know at the time we had a television team in there. They were immediately kicked out, and it was only about 15 years later that somebody said to me, oh, by the way, Harry, you know, when you ran that story on British Guiana, you ruined a multi-million dollar enterprise. And then he said, and good for you. And it was the same when I took up the thalidomide case. These children, you know, poisoned, deformed by a drug manufactured by the company Distillers, which made all the whiskey. We got £60,000 of advertising from distillers. The advertising director rang me when he knew I was going to go ahead with this terrific attack on distillers. He said, "Harry, you know, we get £60,000 a year advertising." He paused, and then he said, "I know it won't stop you, and it shouldn't." That's an amazing attitude from a commercial operation.
When you were publishing the Crossman Diaries, and there was some risk of violating official secrets, the same Roy Thompson, under whatever pressure he was, asked you simply, "You happy in your own mind, Harold?" And that was it.
I remember showing him outside the front door, expecting the government motorcyclist to arrive with a lawyer's thing closing the paper, and he went off quite cheerful, as long as it was a good read. The most amazing thing to me was when we investigated and exposed the fact that the British government had covered up the fact that Kim Philby, the most amazing spy, which nobody realised he was until we proved it, had been protected by his pals in the British Secret Service. Whereupon I was accused of being a traitor for publishing this, and the Foreign Secretary himself got up at a dinner where the owner of the paper was, and he said, "Why are you harbouring this traitor?" Meaning me. Well, my chairman rang me and said, "You better get ready to be blasted in the House of Commons tomorrow." Actually, the Foreign Secretary had thought better of it because he'd been drunk the night before. Or rather, as the Times newspaper put it, he was in the ebullient mood, which was the code for drunkenness. He was showing marked ebullience. We know what Roy Thompson's attitude was that? Bunk. Bunk is what he said. So I was very lucky. You know, by the way, when I did the thalidomide campaign, I had no idea, that we would be successful as we were in gaining compensation. I had no idea that we were the beginning of an 8-year legal battle to publish it.
And compensation now, the children.
Yes, getting compensation for children who had no arms in many cases, since in many cases no arms or legs, and massive internal injuries and no compensation. It was an absolute outrage which no newspaper could write about because of the laws of England on contempt of court. So we challenged that, and then we proved that their case was far greater. In fact, their case was unanswerable for compensation because the drug company had been negligent, and the lawyers had actually failed to establish that. But we established it. We established that there'd been negligence. Now, the interesting thing is that after all those years of fighting, 8 years of it, in fact, although I got compensation for them fairly quickly, you know, about 3 or 4 months of campaigning, last week in the British House of Commons, I really must pay tribute to the Labour government over there, because they came, the Minister of Health, to the dispatch box in Commons, and he said, "I want now to apologise on behalf of the British government to the thalidomide victims." Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
I mean, governments rarely admit error. I mean, nobody likes admitting error, but governments, with all the civil service and the apparatus, and the government actually, you know, made some financial provisions for those kids, you know, they're not kids now, they're young adults who are in the 50s, 40s and 50s, whose bodies are 25 years older than their chronological age.
Yeah.
But that was a great moment for me last week. I sat in my apartment in New York watching a podcast. You're the guy who invented podcasts. I'm watching a podcast with an armless young woman who had tears in her eyes. She was about 45 or 46, very beautiful young woman, but nonetheless incapacitated to a certain extent. And we thought what a magical moment it was when truth prevails.
Harold Evans, come back to the Times, and the Roy Thompson standard was that you couldn't have the job unless you were going to exercise your own independence. Rupert Murdoch bought the papers eventually and turned that quite upside down, fired you, and has done pretty much the same thing at the Wall Street Journal, too, in the sense that he promised to keep hands off the choice of the editor, but then quickly asserted the owner's right to have the man he wanted. Where's the publisher in the world today who would vouch for the sort of independence that made your career?
Well, I think the owners of the Financial Times have that integrity. I have to say, I haven't seen any, apart from the instance you gave, I haven't seen any overt manipulation of news in the Wall Street Journal. I think they've actually improved the paper for what it's worth. There's actually more news and space given to it. But the Financial Times is one. I think The Economist is another one. Both of them owned by the same company in Britain. And I think The New York Times, too, I must say, and The Washington Post, although The Washington Post recently made a terrible mistake of trying to sell itself to advertisers by giving dinners at the publisher's home. That was a major mistake.
Mm. Go back to your own American days in the 1950s. You found a lot to love in American journalism of the time, even Colonel McCormick's Chicago Tribune. I mean, there was a great vigor and sort of full voice localism and independence in American journalism of your younger days. What's to learn from that?
Well, I think a great deal to learn from it in this sense, that those papers that were truly independent and followed the track to the truth, whether it's the Chicago Tribune exposing the mayor of Chicago as being corrupt and in league with Al Capone and nearly getting killed for his pains, McCormick, or whether it's some brave editor like Ben Bradley, for that matter, in the Watergate, or whether it's the Knight Ritter papers in the pre-Iraq, that succeeds. The public really, really appreciates it. So there isn't just a moral glow from independence. There's actually a monetary reward. One of the reasons, by the way, I must tell you a little story, Chris, which actually sure. exemplifies the point, as well as harks back to something I said before. When the DC-10 airliner crashed, with 380 people dead because of a defect in the door of the DC-10. Nobody could get to the bottom of that story. Why did the plane crash because of the defective door? Why wasn't the door fixed? Hundreds of questions. It took us 2 years, actually, of investigation to prove the negligence of the company. The Congress dropped the issue. The American press didn't even bother to inquire about it. Now, at the same time as when this plane crashed, I sent a television team to France to make a television documentary about this terrible disaster because it was an unnecessary accident because the door had fallen off before, the cargo door had fallen off before on another plane. It should have been fixed. Why wasn't it fixed? Well, that's what our investigation was about. And on the TV side of it, I was at a board meeting, and here's the thing that happened. Here's the financial director, Mr. Michael Brown, who later became head of Thomson Data. I have to report the board, says Mr. Brown, I have to report the board that the Sunday Times had a very good month in terms of circulation, but I'm afraid it has lost £60,000 on a venture inspired by the editor to make a television documentary of the DC-10 airliner.
Mm.
Pause. And I want to congratulate him on service to the public.
Wow. Wow.
I mean, that was the atmosphere. Now, if I'd wasted money in some ridiculous manner, he wouldn't have been pleased or kind or would have reported adversely. But I was sitting on this board with the other directors, and he was tough. He was very, very tough. But he appreciated this, and it's a point you've now raised, that the £60,000 lost on the TV venture, partly because we were new to the game and didn't read the small print properly, was actually an investment in the reputation of the Sunday Times.
Mm.
And that willingness to spend and to risk paid really handsome rewards. Why did the Sunday Times sell 1.5 million copies every Sunday? Why was it the major output for advertisers, place for advertisers? So that when Rupert Murdoch took it over and sorted out the rather corrupt trade unions, he was making £50 million a week profit. Why? Well, one, because Thomson invested in the machinery. Two, because he supported independent journalism.
That was then. I mean, nowadays, the industry in England and the States seems oftentimes to be beyond saving. My real question to you, Harold Evans, is how is to save the craft we're talking about, even the eccentric personalities, the trade, the culture, the critical standards, those people who are tough and have a code, and especially a code of independence? I mean, take a deep breath and think of three people, five people, 10 people that if you could just bring them out of your history into the 21st century as models for digital journalism, I mean, who would they be? Who are the heroes of your own experience?
Well, Bruce Page, who was...
Thank you, yeah.
I would name, first of all, it was in his Insight team, who was an autodidact. He dropped out of Sydney University. If you argued with him, he would be quoting Keynes, Macaulay, Coleridge. He was self-educated, but quite brilliant, and he would totally, although he was a member of the Labour Party, he was totally, totally without any political prejudice whatsoever. I would bring him for investigations. John Barry, who went into Northern Ireland and reported the ill treatment of the prisoners in internment, another great investigator. I'd bring David Leitch. David Leitch went to Khe San, where the American Marines were holding out, and brought to his story a lyricism and superb quality of writing. Those Marines in that dreadful place at Khe San were actually individuals. We could see them. It wasn't just a factual report. It was actually colourful. Or take somebody like an editor, because they raised a very important point about credibility and accuracy. Peter Wiltshire, the editor of the Business News, for instance, who had a braying voice, and this is Peter Wiltshire in action. A reporter would put a story in front of him, and Wiltshire would say, "That's all very well, but what does it mean, chum?" So the reporter, humiliated, had to go back and try and make his rather clever piece comprehensible to ordinary everybody, to people like me, for instance. It was such a vast range.
I was just going to say, most of those are new names to American readers, but we get the point. I mean, we have our own cast, too. I bet it's just suddenly dawned on me that people like Jimmy Breslin or Murray Kempton in New York or Anthony Lewis on The New York Times or Russell Baker, the people that I worshipped growing up, they're simply not making them anymore. I don't think.
I know, it's great, but it's we need those people. I mean, they brought they gave reporting a literary quality. Anthony Lewis, of course, had this marvelous logistical mind. He could take a case apart, and his books are also very illuminating. And Jimmy Breslin. There are a few people like that today. There's a marvelous piece by Richard Cohen in today's Daily News in New York about Harold Ford, who wants to run for the New York Senate, who's all things to all men. And Richard Cohen deconstructs his campaign in the most marvelous and funny way. So there are still people around, but I think there's a diminishing brigade of them. One of the problems, I think, Chris, is this. We keep confusing truth and information. Mm. Information is just a flow of facts. It doesn't necessarily represent the truth. And the hardest thing to do in journalism is to create understanding.
Well, in today's world, that seems to be the big question, whether the story of our troubles, our place in the world, our economy, is still, shall we say, reducible to a narrative that is convincing.
Well, I think it is, but you do need the skills. And by the way, one of my criticisms of certain styles of investigative journalism in print, it doesn't apply so much to the web, is it doesn't mean it's important because it's long. You have to make the stories interesting. You have to arouse interest. That was the first requirement. The first requirement of journalists within is to be curious. And the second thing is to make it comprehensible, make it clear. Again and again, I mean, just take for if you want a case of not making it clear, you look at the White House report on this underpants bomber.
Yes.
And the summary, it is a total mishmash of incomprehensible sentences. Same with the health thing. In fact, I might write a book about this because it's enraging me that the English language is so despoiled by bureaucraties, so that comprehension for the people who are at the receiving end of all this legislation isn't easily achieved, because it's wrapped up in so much garbage of words and not properly edited. And that's one thing which in the British press, and even better than the American press, much better than the American press, in fact, is the quality of what we call the sub-editing, to make sure, is it clear? Does it make sense? Can it be said shorter?
Harold Evans, let me ask, who's going to pay for the new journalism? And if there is vital public value here, should it get a serious public subsidy?
I'm not in favor of a subsidy personally, although I know that great work is done by public broadcasting in the States. There's also, I'm slightly worried about the pressures on the BBC when they need the subsidy and they've got a government which is getting critical of them. So there's a vulnerability about a public subsidy, which is, I'd much prefer the other alternative, which is not also, has also its problems, which is public interest bodies. For instance, in England, one of my reporters, Elaine Potter, crucial to the thalidomide story, actually became quite wealthy, partly because of her husband. And she's endowed a foundation now, which is just starting work on doing investigative journalism, filling up the gap which is perceived to be there. In the United States, is ProPublica, run by a former editor of the Wall Street Journal. Again, a charitable foundation. That's a possibility. There are one or two centres for investigative journalism. But I tell you what, I think what I'm hoping, and this is, you can see me on my knees here, what I'm hoping is that we will emerge, one, with a print press, which will be reduced, but which will be able to be economical by print on demand. Hewlett-Packard makes a machine now which you can print a newspaper at your home, or you can go to your corner shop, because the machine costs something less than $3,000, so the corner shop could afford it, corner deli, corner diner, whatever. That reduces newspaper costs by quite a considerable amount. The second thing I'm hoping is that the monetization, horrible word, but actually making the web pay, is on its way. The Wall Street Journal is making inroads here, charging for its content. The New York Times is going to charge for its content. The Daily Beast, which I, of course, regard with a certain amount of awe, is not charging for its content yet. The question then is, the advertising revenue going to be enough? Well, I live in hope. As I keep saying, I wear a badge. Beware, this man is an eternal optimist. I do believe that if we can get the right model out of the fantastic flow of information, which is now available to everybody pretty well, we will be able to create something approximating the truth, which is not so easily obtained.
I've also believed, I must say, that crowdsourced journalism could work, that not just information, but wisdom and truth and observation, commentary, substance can be distilled out of the blogosphere, which has a tendency with links to surface the best. But I'm wondering, and I'm a little shaken in that hope. It doesn't bring those sub-editors back that you're so devoted to.
No, it doesn't. And of course, the web is not as good for reading long pieces as print. But I do believe that the plodding newspaper reporter is better than any secret police. In other words, governments do not really know what the hell's going on. They really don't. I mean, the civil service, they've got their Northern Ireland was a particular case in point, where the British government didn't know really what was going on in Northern Ireland with, you know, the discrimination against the Catholics and so on, not to the extent to which it was. So the plodding reporter is superior to the bureaucracy. So that's why we have to keep the plodding reporters. I must say that I've seen some spectacular good stuff on the internet. For instance, the distortion of what happened in Lebanon was exposed by a website called Zombie, I think it is, Z-O-M-B-I-E, where frauds were perpetrated on the public about what the Israelis had done and what the Israelis hadn't done. and the press fell for it and just published this garbage. So the web is a very, very good corrective. There's another site which I recommend very strongly to readers who want to keep, or viewers or whatever we may be, citizens who want to keep an eye on what they're being told, the Daily Howler, H-O-W-L-E-R.
Yeah.
In the election campaigns, which I've lived through in the United States, I've never seen so much stereotyping distortion about candidates. For instance, it's what I call the story mode syndrome. A reporter, I have one in mind here, gets an idea in her head that Al Gore is a bore. Okay, so everything has to fit that scenario. So everything, whatever Al Gore did in that election against Bush, was represented in a boring fashion. He was basically caricatured. All that is laid out in the Daily Howler. And I wrote a piece about it for the Columbia Journalism Review. But basically, the American press and television, too, are subject to this, what I call, story mode syndrome. Here's the hypothesis. Now find a few facts to fit this image of the individual or the politician or the situation that we're talking about.
You say in a rather tantalizing way toward the end of your book that if we evolve the right financial model, we will enter a golden age of journalism. If pigs grow wings, they'll fly too. what's your notion of that model?
Okay, so here's my my notion is that the best independent websites, not those coming from newspapers, but the best independent websites, Huffington Post, The Beast, Talking Points, will actually acquire the resources to do more original reporting. There is no substitute for reporting. No substitute for reporting. That's what we need. I'm hoping that will come. However, it has to be said that although information isn't knowledge or meaning, it isn't understanding. When, for instance, I had to write an editorial recently for The Guardian in England, I was able to summon up the 500-page report on the internet and read it within the next hour and a half, whereas previously I've had to send for it, wait for it, get it, and so on. So there's a lot of stuff at the fingertips. And
right.
Secondly, you can go to prime sources so easily through the browser engines. We'll save a vast amount of time. You can get statistics of the kind we need about what's happening to house prices. It's all there. And then, of course, if you're smart enough, you can make it work. So what I'm thinking is that with the great profusion of information coming through the browsers and the search engines, use with discrimination, because some of it's not accurate, use with discrimination allied to really intelligent journalism, inheriting some of the values you and I have taught this morning about literacy and comprehension and wit and preserving the culture, that we'll actually manage. And I do think we will see newspapers surviving, especially with print on demand, and fewer titles probably more discrepancy coming in the future between the red top tabloids, as we call them, and the serious papers. Number of titles probably diminished across the country, and great problems in some regions and so on, allied to the web. So you'll get local web services, you'll get national web sources, and you'll get the diminished number of active newspapers. But I think out of that combination, we may have a better flow of truth even than we had in the golden days of what I call my time at the Sunday Times.
I was just going to say, maybe this is my last question. Part of your success in the Sunday Times, Harold Evans, was certain collective journalism and that insight team, most obviously. But also you had the imprint of what became a great masthead and a reputation of a newspaper and its integrity. Will we ever see, I mean, the Sunday Times says this, the Sunday Times says that. It came to mean something. Will we ever see that again?
That's a very, very, very good point, if I may. So one thing which I've not touched on here in talking to you, which you really raised, is the credibility and authority that goes with the title. And that, I think, reminds me of another quality. When you've got a big-selling national newspaper with a reputation to maintain by its credibility and its accuracy, like the Sunday Times or the Times or the New York Times or the Boston Globe, whatever, when you've got that, you have a megaphone you're not just appealing to, you know, a few thousand people in an assembly in a political meeting. I was 4 or 5 million people read the Sunday Times.
Yeah.
So when we blasted into that megaphone, apart from the fact that the echoes were picked up by competitors and by other people, it was a really powerful instrument. And one of the things which slightly bothers me is that if we have a profusion of websites and a diminished number of newspapers, and we don't have that capacity of the authoritative megaphone, we are going to lose something very important.
Harold Evans, it's such a pleasure. And some of your cheerfulness rubs off, I think. we will plunge ahead with great thanks for not only the work of a lifetime, but for this book, My Paper Chase, True Stories of Vanished Times by Harold Evans. A great pleasure.
Thank you, Chris.
Paul McCarthy edited this conversation with Harold Evans, whose newspaper memoir is titled My Paper Chase, True Stories of Vanished Times. Ben Mandelkern was the associate producer and right-hand reader on the case. Post your own obituary for newspapers or your own life-saving remedy for them with a comment on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden. Thank you for being part of the conversation.